So in a GP, you get your own office and your own desk, and you get those spinny chairs, and that's really all I want. And under computer systems that they use, they've all got a little chat function, so you can just chat with the receptionist and ask for tea. And that sounds like perfect.
That is the life.
Get my own office, a spinny chair, and I just get to chat to people all day and drink tea. Perfect.
I'm Carissa Weiser. Welcome to Career Day. This is a podcast where I talk with strangers all around the world about their life, identity, sense of belonging, and how career fits into that picture. Today, I'm sharing the story of Rahan, whose quest for the perfect chair led to the most remarkable discoveries about himself and what matters most.
Hi, I'm Rahan, and I'm a junior doctor.
Awesome. For those people that don't know, what does it mean when you say a junior doctor?
Well, it's quite a broad term. It's any doctor below consultant level, which is anyone who's really training still.
Gotcha.
So I'm just starting my training now. I've only been qualified for a few months. So I'm like the most junior of junior doctors at the moment.
Well, going into medical school is a really long road. Is that what you always saw yourself doing?
Well, my dad is a GP, so he has his own practice in Lincoln, which is my hometown. And so I basically spent my entire childhood, if I wasn't at school, at the surgery. So I kind of grew up around healthcare and grew up around primary care especially. And I was quite good at science at school. So after a while, it sort of seemed a bit inevitable that I would end up going into the family business, which wasn't something I was particularly against, to be honest. It's always interested me as a discipline, like the variety that you get with it.
Yeah. There's always something different that you could be doing. So is your dad happy that you followed his footsteps?
I think it was generally supportive. I got to see firsthand sort of the good and bad bits about being a doctor, and it's not an easy thing to do, especially being a GP nowadays. It's very busy, very long hours, quite unrewarding work at times. But I think he was happy in the end that I decided to go for it anyway. I know a lot of people who went to medical school only seeing a certain side of medicine and sort of the cool, exciting bit that you see on the TV and the things that you hear about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm like 90% sure he was happy that I was going into medical school.
That's a good percent.
Yeah, it's about as good as I can get for anything, really.
Rahan said he went to school in Lincoln all throughout his early life. And then at age 16, he had to start making these big decisions about all the courses he was going to take. You had to make sure that they would match up later with all the medical school prerequisites.
I think it was just normal childhood. I spent a lot of time doing extracurricular activities because you need to bolster out your CV, even at school. So I worked in a nursing home for a little while, just sort of to figure out what was going on with the caring aspect of healthcare rather than sort of medicine aspect, which is all I'd really experienced. And I did this award, which is run by the Duke of Edinburgh, who's the Queen's husband, but not the King. Never figured that out. And that took up quite a lot of my sort of 16 to 18 year old spare time, was doing stuff for that. So we had to go on walks and we had to do volunteering activities and stuff like that.
So then now, what is your long-term goal in medicine? What do you want to focus on within medicine?
Well, I've got quite lofty ambitions for medicine, actually. I don't know if it's going to be achievable, but I always thought it was better to have sort of unattainable ambitions rather than ones that you get too easily, because then I get bored. So the way that the healthcare system in the UK is delivered at the moment is fantastic because it's nationalized and it's free at the point of care and stuff. But the way that it works behind the scenes isn't great. It's a bit creaky. It doesn't quite match up with the way that healthcare should be being delivered these days. So what I want to do is kind of bring things that are traditionally done in hospitals into the community, where GPs and other primary care physicians can start to deliver these services that they previously couldn't. And the area that I particularly want to focus on is mental health, because I think it's just horribly delivered. It's a really terrible service at the moment, and there's a lot of scope for improvement. And I think it's a really important area of medicine that's often been swept under the carpet a little bit. Now, actually, it's getting the recognition that it deserves, but there's sort of an institutional problem with it at the moment.
Why do you think that mental health has been swept under the carpet for so long?
I don't know, actually. I ask myself this question quite a lot, because it's something that affects so many people, and I don't understand why no one talks about it, or traditionally no one talks about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get people who are suffering immensely, suffering really terribly with these conditions. And because they're not visible or because they're taboo in some way, they just don't talk about it. And that makes it so much worse. And it makes it even more difficult for other people to talk about because there's no conversation being had at all.
Yeah. If I were to tell you that I've talked to people in mental health in Australia, in the UK, in Canada, in the US, in other countries, and everyone universally says that it's not talked about enough and there needs to be more awareness, would that surprise you?
Not in the slightest. I think it's nice, the change that we are going through as a society at the moment, where because people are forcing these conversations, everyone else is sort of becoming a bit more literate with their mental health, finding better ways of expressing themselves and better ways of communicating with people the troubles that they or other people might be having. So I think the future is looking good, but we've come from such a long time where there's just been nothing done at all that it's going to take a lot of these small conversations to really make any noticeable difference, I think.
So why is mental health so taboo, so difficult to talk about even today? I wish that you could hear the conversations I've had on this topic all at the same time. Perspectives from school psychology, psychiatry, a suicide hotline, youth mental health programs from around the world. I wish that you could hear it all at once. What I will say for now, though, is that it's easy to say we need to talk about mental health. We need to have more open conversations about it. But it is another thing completely to be the one who's actually doing the talking.
When I was finishing up my A-levels, when just before my 18th birthday, one of my good friends was killed in a car crash. And this sort of affected me quite a lot, as you can imagine, but it affected my studies significantly. So the A-level exams that I took, I just didn't really try for and ended up getting quite not very good A-level results. Well, they weren't bad. They just weren't good enough to get into medical school. And I was applying to university around this same time as well. I kept on getting rejection after rejection after rejection. I ended up getting 4 rejections that year. So it really took a toll on my mental health. I felt really low. And so I come out of school basically with not good enough results and no university place. I had nothing really to do, and I wasn't really sure what to do with myself. So my mum and dad suggested that I go to college in Oxford to redo these A-levels. So I did that, got another A-level just, you know, for kicks, and I reapplied to medical school. And I still didn't get in. So I had to deal with 4 more rejections, but I got a few interviews this time, so I got a bit of practice. But at that point, I saw that all the people that I went to school with were sort of established at university. They were having a good time. They were sort of going into their second year at that point. And so I was like, I want in on that. So I made a sort of rash decision, potentially, to go through clearing to Queen Mary University in London to study biochemistry, which wasn't particularly what I wanted to do, but I just wanted to go to university. And I quite liked the idea of going to university in London. So whilst I was there, I was sort of getting into the swing of things, but I knew this, it wasn't the kind of thing that I wanted to do for my life. So I applied with a bit of encouragement from my mum to medical school again on the whim, and I got in. So I was very lucky. So eventually I did start. My first year was quite difficult because the workload is quite intense compared to what other people are experiencing, certainly on other courses. And I don't think I was mentally quite prepared for it. And on top of that, I still had to deal with this long-standing low mood that I had from my friend dying. So that's when I first had my first sort of major lapse into depression. And it was quite a difficult year for me, first year, and moving on through into the second year of university is quite a lot to handle. But then sort of, I think I turned a corner in my third year. And then since then, with a few blips here and there, I've been largely all right.
Yeah. Did you feel like that was something you had to hide from people, from your peers and your friends?
Yeah, you have this, I don't know why, looking back on it, it was a ridiculous thing to be thinking. But I guess I'm a victim of society's unwillingness to talk about mental health as anyone else, really. I spent a long time not telling my parents what was wrong, not telling the university what was wrong. I was quite worried about the medical school and what they would think about my mental health condition and their role to play within it. So it took me a while to come forward. And I think that was a detriment to me, really, because it meant I was in a much worse state when I was starting to talk about it and starting to open up about it to the people that needed to hear about it.
What was helpful for you in changing how you were thinking about it? And you mentioned that the third year was a lot better. How do you get to that point?
To be honest, I don't really know. I had a really good group of friends, and they were instrumental in helping me through what I was going through. And then I think I started to realize that the way I was feeling wasn't necessarily my own fault. Like, I'm just sort of made up of all of the chemicals flying around inside my brain. And if they're not working properly, then I'm probably not going to be working properly. So when I started to realize and subscribe to the biological theory of depression, then I found it easier to deal with what was happening to me. I guess in the same way that if you had some sort of physical health condition and you understood it a bit better, then you'd be in a better position to help yourself because you know what are good and bad things to do and how to keep yourself well. So, yeah, when I stopped seeing mental health and physical health as separate things, then that's when I think things started to look up.
That term, biological mental health, I really like that. That really puts it in perspective for me and hopefully for a lot of people too. It's really good. If you were to give a message to people all over the world, you know, what does the public need to know about mental health? What would you say?
Probably that it's quite normal, given the lives that we all lead nowadays, that everyone's under so much pressure all the time, that it shouldn't feel as abnormal as it does to have a low mood or to be anxious. And I think that the more people understand that not everyone is the preferred term for it now is neurotypical, but it's okay not to be. 1 in 4 people will experience some sort of mental health challenge in their life, but there's loads more to it than that. Like 10% of mothers and 6% of fathers at any one time have a mental health problem, certainly in the UK. I don't know what it's like and elsewhere in the world, but that's so many people who have to deal with all of their own things as well as having to look after a child or multiple children. It sort of beggars belief after a while how prevalent these conditions are when we still don't talk about them. Even something people would think as rare as schizophrenia, it's 1 in 100 people, I think, is the statistic that I learned in university. Like 1% of the population, that's like 6 million people in the UK, might be hearing something that's not there or seeing something that's not there, which is loads.
And yet we still don't talk about it.
Yeah, exactly. I can't get my head around it. It's ridiculous.
I think one of the issues around mental health might be that we're afraid people will think that one label becomes what defines us, when the truth is that who we are is both dynamic and complex.
So outside of work and outside of school, what kind of things do you like to do?
So when you sent through the list of messages, this was the question I was worried about the most. Because like when you spend so much of your life doing one thing, it's difficult to disentangle yourself from it. So I was talking to my girlfriend about it, and she was just talking about all the different things that I've done that I can't even remember doing. Like I recently got into death, but not in like a morbid way. I find it interesting the way that people talk about it and the way that people avoid it. So I did this course on bereavement awareness and bereavement counselling with a charity in the UK called Cruise. And that was really eye-opening. I think it just showed me that it's like chatting to people. So all I do with my time is just talk about stuff. I go to gigs and I like go and hang out in town. Is that something that people do? I don't know. Hang out in town?
I think so.
I know. I used to do it when I was a child, when I was old enough to be let out of the house. And then I started doing it again recently, and I was like, actually, this is really fun, because now I have the like spending power to just buy stuff as well.
Yes.
It got even better.
How about any hidden talents?
Yes. Actually, no, this is the opposite of a talent. I'm terrible to putting together furniture. It's something I've recently learned about myself. Otherwise, I literally have no idea. I have no idea what I'm good at. I'm good at stuff, you know, usually useless stuff.
I want to explore this being bad at putting together furniture. What happened that you realized that this was not one of your strengths?
Well, I mean, my bed is still standing, which is a good thing. But there are days where I just wonder how long it's going to keep going for. It's not as simple as I initially anticipated putting together IKEA furniture. Like, it comes with those simplistic instructions that are just stick men with smiles and hammers. But that's just not what it's like at all. There's so many different parts. Nuts.
Yeah.
And so there's one particular bit of my bed which isn't quite as strong as the rest of it because I had some sort of nightmare trying to get it all to fit together. I just avoid that corner.
I've heard people joke that IKEA furniture would be a great premarital counseling exercise. You know, if you can survive putting together furniture together, you can get through anything.
Yeah, I would probably agree with that. I've got actually a whole list of things that I'm bad at. I once tried to, when I was in my first year of university, I decided with my housemate at the time, who's gone on to become a very good friend of mine, to do a radio show because we had some hilarious conversations with each other. So we were like, you know what, we could do this on the radio. Turns out it's way more difficult to have a radio show than I initially anticipated because we thought it would be a really good idea to have a request show, but no one listened. So there's no requests. And to be honest, it's a good thing that no one listened because it was terrible.
What was your show called?
I think it was called Purple Requests. The university color is purple and the student radio station was called Purple Radio. So we thought we were going to be challenging with the sort of big national radio DJs for airtime and listeners. You know, the exuberance of youth.
How long did that show last before you guys said, you know what, never mind?
Well, so you get a term slot, and our campuses was one of the satellite campuses to the main Durham campus. So we had to get a bus in every Sunday morning at like 7 o'clock, just so we can get there on time for our show, which started at 11 or 12 or something. So we'd always have all these dramas about trying to get there on time, or if one of us just wasn't around, then the other person would have to just go to the show on their own and stuff.
That sounds kind of terrible.
It was hilariously bad.
It sounds a lot of fun too.
It was fun.
Nice. If you guys ever want to try it again, you could get into podcasting, you know.
Well, actually, I have been thinking about it because I started listening to loads of podcasts recently. They came out on Spotify one day and I was like, well, what is this whole genre that I've missed out on? So if this whole medicine thing goes to pot, then I just make a podcast about me doing things badly.
My favorite part about Career Day is getting to know people. Part of that is learning what they do, but like mental health, there's a lot more to it than that. Sometimes part of who we are is a product of who else is in our life.
Well, I mean, I guess you think I'm going to say my dad, which I am. My family when I was growing up was really important to me. And although I wasn't usually the best child, I was kind of annoying and a bit naughty as well. So I didn't really display my appreciation for them that much when I was growing up, but sort of reflectively, it's clear to see from the way I act now and the way I am with people and things that I do and the things that I enjoy that I've just taken so much from them. But then every so often you run into these people who make you think about things in different ways. A couple that stick out, my girlfriend, obviously, I have to plug her a little bit.
That's right.
And there's a guy in Newcastle called Steve O'Driscoll who he's just a regular guy, but he's just been through so much and he's very articulate. He's got a very good way of conveying how he's feeling and what has been happening, all of the sort of at times awful things that have been happening to him. But he's just come out and he's just this fantastic guy. I really like hanging out with him. I really like chatting to him. So he's quite an inspiration to me, especially nowadays when I think about the way that I want to approach healthcare in the future. And being able to draw on someone like his experience and just being in his presence has really changed me and changed the way that I look at mental health and physical health and life in general, really.
It is breaking down the wall, the stigma that surrounds mental health, learning to share your own story, and growing in the strength of others sharing in kind. There's a lot more to it, but perhaps that's part of changing how we view a hurt that might not be visible, but is still very real. That's what's working for Rahan.
My last and biggest question. Do you finally have the spinny chair?
No, actually. I don't get to sit down at all at work. Like being a doctor is nothing like I was expecting, to be honest. Like I've got just spend all my time like running around doing boring jobs. But one day I'm going to get this chair. I'm going to write my name on it. That's going to be mine forever.
Don't get it at IKEA, because you have to put it together.
Well, yeah, or I'll just get someone else to put it together for me. At that point, I'd be like, I'm a doctor, I don't put together my own chairs.
There you go.
Use some of that social standing that I'll accrue.
That's when you know you've really arrived.
Exactly, exactly. The dream is I can just go in somewhere and be like, oh, Dr. Ansari, and I'll be like, please, please, that was my dad.
Today's episode of Career Day is dedicated to Rehan's dad, who passed away shortly after the conversation you heard today. He made a big difference in Rehan's life, and if you're a listener today, I know he touched yours as well. Special thanks to Rehan for sharing his story so boldly with the world. For more info on anyone on the podcast or to be considered for the show, head on over to careerdayshow.com. I'd also love to hear from you on Twitter at Carissa Weiser or on Facebook at Career Day Show. And if you like the podcast, the best thing you can do is leave a good review on iTunes. Simply go to itunes.careerdayshow.com, also linked in the show notes, or on the iOS podcast app. This is a great way to help other people find the show. So thanks also to everyone who's left a review so far, including Ken from Honolulu, Adam W09, Irish Law 5, Morg Z, Rick Barker, Bookworm in an Apple, Hammer Time 9000, Fun by Fly, Fourth, and Mugsy 2020. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you next time on Career Day.